Gibbs, founder of Incandescent Public Relations, publisher of Being Incandescent Business Magazine, and your host for the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show on the Incandescent Radio Network, the voice of entrepreneurs. Hi, this is Hope Gibbs. I am your host of the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show here on the Incandescent Radio Network. And we are here today with New York Times bestselling author Poe Bronson, author of 6 books, including his latest, Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, which he co-authored with Ashley Merriman, who also wrote his last book with him, Nurture Shock. And that book upends what you might think about good parenting. In this new book, the authors touch on an equally sensitive nerve, the science of competition. It is chock full of research and keen analysis, and the authors answer questions including, what are the differences between a winning and losing performance? Why are we able to rise to the challenge one day, but wilt from it the next? And most importantly, perhaps, they help readers determine if they can, in fact, become better competitors. We are thrilled to be here today having lunch with Poe and interviewing him at Fisherman's Wharf at a restaurant called Loli's Castanoga, which is in Poe's hometown of San Francisco. So hello, Poe. Welcome to the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. So you and Ashley are our Entrepreneurs of the Month in June 2013 issue of Be Incandescent magazine, and we are really excited to share with our readers and listeners the findings of your book. So first tell us, what inspired you to write Top Dog?
Well, a few different things kind of came together. I want to say this is a topic that I've always been interested in, but was pushing me was, I'll come at it from two ways. One was just life experience. So several years ago, my son, I manage and volunteer youth soccer in San Francisco. I have like 8,000 kids in San Francisco, including my kids' teams. And my son's team, you know, at third grade, we selected all of these great players in the city to form a travel team. And some of these kids were phenomenal. And a lot of them were all very good. But when they had to go up against other people who were equally as good, and that was a new experience for them, when they actually were having to be challenged directly, they had very divergent responses. Some kids could thrive in that situation, and other kids could not handle it. And as their coach, I was really like, I'm like, this kid is an amazing player but cannot play in the games. And like, what is going on and why? And how can I help these kids? I really, really wanted to help them. I wanted to understand, but I wanted to help them. And then from the other perspective was, while we were researching Nurture Shock, we did hear little bits of science that we sort of stored for later. And one of these was at a conference held by Sylvia Bungay at University of California, Berkeley. It was a neuroscience conference. And Ashley and I, as journalists, we're often regarded by the scholars as people who, like, come to their science conference. They invite us to their science conferences to participate, you know, and with the notion of, you know, maybe years later we'll write about all this stuff. And Adele Diamond, a neuroscientist from University of British Columbia, was talking about a gene that determines why some people can be great at things as long as they're not under stress. They're not under a lot of pressure. They perform really well until they're under stress and pressure. While there are other types of people, in equal number, who actually need stress and pressure to perform their best. And this, to me, when she talked about this gene, the comp gene, and it's gone on to be nicknamed the warrior gene, I was hearing this and thinking about these kids, and I'm like, those are the kids on the soccer field. Like, that's the kids who can do great in practice, but in the pressure of a game, literally, like, they act stupid. They don't seem to figure it out. They look like they're untrained. Their brains aren't working. It's not their body. Their brains aren't working. While in other kids who, in practice, like, that kid's, you know, only so-so. But in a game, he or she, there were some girls on the team too, would step up and really be amazing. And that confluence of hearing that there was a gene for this and my observation was phenomenal, I thought that there was something there. And the question was, you know, could we find the science to help explain all these different factors that are going into performance, how we react to competition, how we react to being challenged, when should we compete and when should we not compete? That kind of thing.
Excellent. Wow. So let's get into this research. You use cutting-edge science to tease out the hidden factors at the core of every great triumph and every great failure. And you explain game-changing insights into the nature of competition, including why the home field advantage in sports is just as relevant in diplomacy and deal-making. So we definitely want to hear about that. You also explain why women are better at judging risk and men are better at ignoring it. And that reminds me of Lou Ann Lofton's book, Warren Buffett Invests Like a Girl, and mm-hmm. you should too. And then there are the insights why younger siblings are more competitive than firstborns, and the fact that the shape of an entrepreneur's hands can be as revealing as their business plans. So dive into some of these fascinating scientific findings.
Which one do you want me to start with first?
Well, let's
you just
start
did
with
that, you just mentioned the hands, and I think that when people hear that, that you have to go there.
Okay, go hands first.
So because entrepreneurs, you know, the idea that I could, or venture capitalist or financier could look at your hand, and that would tell them as much about who they are as, say, their resume or something, is a very controversial and scary idea. So to listeners out there, what you want to do is look at your right hand and straighten your fingers out as straight as possible on your right hand, together, all pointing in the same direction. And you're looking at the index finger, the first finger next to the thumb, and how long that is, and then skipping the middle finger, going to the ring finger. And you're looking at the length of the index finger and the length of the ring finger, and which one is longer. Now, in a normal population, two-thirds of men and one-third of women are going to have longer ring fingers than index fingers. It doesn't have to be much longer. It actually can be just tiny, tiny, tiny bit longer. But that right there, having a longer ring finger than index finger, is a biomarker for being predisposed to take risks. And it makes you comfortable with risk, makes you enjoy and satisfied with risk. It gives you spatial ability, and it gives you associated with entrepreneurship and risky careers with high, like volatile career choices. So just from that alone, there is a study, Aldo Rusticini did a study of 3,000 entrepreneurs in Italy, and the ratio of those two finger lengths predicted the size of the company amongst entrepreneurs and the growth rate of the company. A similar study looked at traders in the city of London and found that that finger length ratio is associated with how much money that they made. Closer to home, Paola Sapienza, who is a scholar at Northwestern University, she studies MBA grads from nearby University of Chicago. And she can, looking at people's fingers and actually just doing a little saliva test, can actually predict quite well which MBA grads are going to go into risky, volatile careers, which ones are going to take stable, conservative jobs coming out of business school. So you might be wondering, what is going on? Why is that possible? Well, when we are fetuses marinating in our mother's womb, well, we're being bathed in a lot of hormones. And there are a lot of receptors, hormone receptors on the fingers, and those hormones lengthen the fingers. So the length of the fingers become a marker for what kind of hormones were you bathing in. Those same hormones, and those receptors are on the fingers, are on the early limbic brain as it's forming. And so the different ratio of testosterone and estrogen and other hormones in the womb affects the cell migration in the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is of all the endocrine glands, it's like all roads leading back to Rome or all rivers leading to the Nile. You know, it's like it's the origin point of our hormonal response to challenge. And so finger length is a good marker for subtle, small brain differences in the limbic portion of our brains that affects how we take risk, whether we're sensitized to reward or sensitized to fears, whether we want things or whether we're careful around things. It also, I mentioned, it affects spatial ability, aggressiveness. And so it's amazing that I saw you looking at your fingers while we were doing this. Where did you? I happen to be someone who, of course, I like the science because it shows I'm a risk taker. Mm-hmm. I have a long ring finger. And you're, let's look, you, no, you, okay, so you hope you're, they look right about even, but you can see that this one's a little lower here too. So if you actually measured that down to the hundredth of an inch, we would see that your ring finger is a little longer than your index finger. And it certainly would suggest that, especially as a female, that you're probably pretty comfortable taking risk. Yeah.
So what, now tell us, all right, let's go back to the first question. Why are women better at judging risk than men?
The first is that people need to know that that's true. So, so a good example would be on Wall Street. Female financial analysts are 7.3% more accurate than male financial analysts. They are creating an earnings estimate for each company every quarter, and women are better capable of analyzing the risks on average than men financial analysts are for, you know, the risk that those companies are facing. We see this in a recent study of female-run hedge funds outperform male-run hedge funds. You know, judging risk is a good thing in certain fields, but judging a risk is not the same as taking a risk. So to be an entrepreneur means to take a big risk, often a risk that actually is kind of foolish, but you have this hubris, this idea of, well, the odds on average of me succeeding here are 1 in 10, but I'm me, I'm not average, I'm somebody, if I can make this work. And so judging risk and taking risk tend to be two separate things, and the ability to judge risk definitely hurts female entrepreneurs because they see a lot of problems. On one hand, it keeps them out of trouble. On the other hand, it keeps them from getting into the trouble in the first place because they see problems in advance, they judge them accurately, and they stay away. They often don't take the same choices or make the same things as men do. This has interesting manifestations. Like, imagine this in a pitching to a venture capitalist, or even just being in an interview. You know, I think of when you're talking about the fact that female financial analysts are better than male analysts, then why are only 16% of the analysts on Wall Street female? Why aren't there higher? And certainly there's bias, and certainly there's other competition for what people, you know, highly talented graduates can do. But more specifically, you imagine an interview room. A woman goes in and she says, you know, here's what I can do for your company, or here's my entrepreneurial idea, here's my venture, and we're going to do $300 million in the next, you know, 5 years, whatever it is. And she's dead accurate, right? She's nailed it. She's perfect. She's perfectly on this side. A guy comes in, and he has this hubris. He has this overconfidence. He's wrong when he says, I'm going to do $600 million in the next 5 years. But it sounds better, right? So women, in the sense, in being accurate, can be, in a sense, under the selling themselves compared to men who will be, in a sense, inaccurate but promise more. So the question is why? Well, why is because, and the exception would be women with these longer ring fingers. They're predisposed to take risk, but they're going to be less good at judging risk, you know? Me with my long ring finger, it means that I'm going to be good at ignoring risk, but it also means I don't see the risks very clearly. That's what helps me ignore them. So there's biological differences. There's also socialization differences, you know, in a lifetime of habits built up from learning to take risks, from competition, you know, from the youngest ages of learning that, you know, people who... To compete successfully means to take risks normally constrained by fear. And what you're really afraid of is losing, afraid of flopping, of losing, of going bankrupt, whatever it might be. And if you've had a lifetime of experience of competing for fun and losing and it not being that big a deal, right? Like, it's fine to lose. I don't care if I lose. I lost, whatever. You know, and you learn to snap back from it. That's vital, because then the risks don't seem as scary. But if you haven't had those experiences with losing, and I'm talking about from the littlest age, like losing at board games and card games and micro-tot soccer games and all these things that where losing really doesn't matter, but you learn to snap back from it, that builds up a psyche, a competitive psyche, where later in life, when you have a real, you know, a real venture on your hand, you need to not be afraid of the downside. And having had a history of having lost, and like, it didn't kill you, you know, helps you overcome that reticence. And that's socialized into us through our families, through a lot of factors in development of childhood, sibling behavior, whether you play in groups or play in pairs, all these things affect this psyche and how we judge risk over time.
That is fascinating. All right, let's go back to some of these other things. Why is the home field advantage in sports just as relevant in diplomacy and deal making? And tell us about the science of the home field advantage.
Okay, so we all know from sports, okay, there is a home field advantage. You know, in basketball, right now we're talking during basketball season, and home teams in basketball win 63% of the time. And so the question is why? Well, we assume that it's you have the audience there, you have your fans, and they're there to support you, and they're making this big deal. Well, in Italy, and they've had entire seasons where teams, because of basically hooliganism, that they've had the home teams have had to play in an empty stadium, play a whole season in an empty stadium. They still hold on to their home field advantage, even without their crowd. And then you have here in the United States, you have situations where a sports team will build a new stadium across town, and they usually lose their home field advantage the first year. They don't, even though they have sleeping in their own bed, they have all of their fans there in the new place, but they lose the home field advantage. And what scholars believe is that actually home field advantage is a deep, primitive response of territorialism. It's deeply wired into our brain. And so much so that it is affecting us in ways we don't even realize, where if you have the home field advantage, very defense can be very protective. And if you don't have the home field advantage, you can unwittingly cede that advantage to the other person. You defer to them. So even in video games, for instance, two players get to a video game, a room where they have to contest each other. The one who gets there just 10 seconds earlier than the other will have a home field advantage, have a predictable like 10%, rather than it being a 50-50 chance to win and lose, it goes to 60-40 because the one got there 10 seconds before. They do these studies where Graham Brown does these studies from business negotiations. So classic, you know, business school types of tasks or business science types of tasks is come in and do these extensive hard negotiations. So he has randomly picks one student to come to this office half an hour before the other one. And there's like posters like a stack of posters and stuff you could choose from. Come to the office and you decorate it a little bit. Put up a few posters, put up a few personal items. But it's not your real office. It's just been there for half an hour. And the next person comes in and then you negotiate. The one who has the home field advantage gets 160% more than the other person out of that negotiation on average.
Wow.
And so what it says is that there are these subtle primes built in our life where if you're going to meet a client or at a Starbucks to talk about something, you know, get there early, get the table, you know, have them sit at your space. If you're going to inside your company, you're having a meeting and someone's like, well, who's going to host the meeting? Who's going to get the conference room, get them to get the bagels and coffee? Say, we'll do it, because you get slight advantages out of these situations that are perhaps imperceptible what their origin is. People don't know why they're doing it, but they're there.
And you say in the book that if you're going to ask for a raise, have your boss come into your office. Tell us about that.
If you can. Well, yeah. No, and if you, that same thing. The science shows that if you can get your boss in your office when you ask for a raise, that's your home turf, and you get more out of it.
I love it. Now, in the book, you also enable readers to identify our own competitive style in hopes of tipping the odds in our favor. Tell us how that works.
Well, this is not a book that says, here's the one way to compete. There are myriads of different biological and sociological and temporary, momentary factors that affect how we perform, affect how much we bring in, how motivated we are, how focused we are. And each of those affects us differently. So the goal of the book is to help people figure out what are the, because someone might say, well, I'm not competitive or something. And usually entrepreneurs won't say that, but what really we're all competitive, we just have to figure out what is the thing that brings that out in us. Where do we compete our best? And a good way to highlight this is actually just the difference between myself and my co-author, Ashley. You know, we actually have learned
how to work together as two journalists over the years. But this book really helped us work better together because we discovered, you know, who am I and who she is. I am someone who really likes competition to be short and intense. And I like it to be aroused and emotionally intense. I like to get under people's skin. And then I want it to be done. And I want to hug it out and, like, go have a beer and forget about it. I need actually a lot of downtime. I need rest.
You're a boy, right?
A rest and recuperation. But Ashley is the opposite. She is someone who she doesn't like it to get intense. She likes to kind of quietly simmer. She loves to master all the facts and details before she does something. I hate facts and details. In fact, like, even as we travel around on tour together, she'll ask me about, like, what think something I'm doing next week. And I'm like, don't ask me, but I don't want anyone to know. I don't want to think about it. But she's a former litigator, so she likes all those details. They empower her. They disempower me. She is there on a day-to-day basis. You know, when we're just writing the book, it's going to take a 3-year project. And, you know, Monday through Friday, that phone rings right at 9 o'clock, and she's raring to go. She's more motivated than I am on a daily basis. But under intense pressure, you know, such as doing a big magazine story and that deadline where we're having to work 19 hours a day, my brain will work a little better than hers does in that type of a situation. So we balance each other. We work really well because we've recognized our strengths and what makes each of us tick and which each of us work.
So I want to get back to how people can incorporate this into their own understanding of competition and how they can. And again, about competition, you know, it's not necessarily beating someone else in every instance. It's about being your best. That's what I'm pulling out of this.
Right. I mean, the people think the benefit of competition is winning. But really, when people have to compete, both everybody who competes, they push themselves, you know. So we have this notion in our society, and it's totally true, which is that we all want to be intrinsically motivated. We want to love what we do. I wrote What Should I Do With My Life? That was the number one New York Times bestseller for a generation. Like 10 years ago, it's still a bestseller. Like, that is a book about finding your intrinsic motivation, right? But as hard as you could push yourself, as best as you could make yourself do something for intrinsic reasons, you would do yet more, pull more out of a hat, accomplish more if you have to compete on top of that. So you take your intrinsic motivation and then you get exposed to competition. Entrepreneurs have to compete with other companies, other people, and that competition makes them accomplish more than they would. Whether they win or lose, it's that they tapped into hidden reserves of creativity and insight and effort because they had to compete, because losing was the other alternative. And to have a healthy attitude towards competition is to understand this, is to understand that by competing, we push each other to get better, mm-hmm. rather than I win, you lose, ha, 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 ha. You know, that's not a healthy attitude to have. So in terms of being specific, so what, like, I think one of the lessons for entrepreneurs that's really important is understanding the power of rivalry and why it works. And it's not that everybody needs to have a rival per se, but if you understand why rivalry is really, really powerful and the alternatives, you can understand how your competitive focus is to be harnessed. So the opposite of a rivalry is where you have a lot of competitors, and it's very diffuse. You don't even know who these people are, and there's infinite number of people you're competing out there.
Just like the SATs?
Feeling like you're competing with lots and lots of people out there, yeah. So the science shows that when you take the SAT test in a room with a lot of other people, in a big gymnasium in a high school where there's 400 people there, scores go down. And when you take it in a small room, like there's just 9 other people there, scores go up drastically. And what's going on is that to be face-to-face with lots and lots of competitors makes you feel like you have no way to beat all these people. I have no way to beat all these people. There's just too many. And the odds of me winning are very poor. When you isolate yourself and you make your focus about winning against just a few competitors, you do much better. Your motivation stays high, your focus stays high, your creativity comes.
And the best example of this is actually in Italy, around the city of Bologna. And interestingly, in the last 15 years, almost everything that we buy these days comes in an interesting package, from the plastic clamshell for the phone to the foil blister pack for someone's heartburn medicine. Not that packaging, but the machine that made that packaging now comes from this little region of Italy. And the secret to their success, they've come to dominate this $30 billion market for packaging machines, is local rivalries that right there in town, often down the street, is the other company that does like cosmetic packaging, or the other company that does wraps and cuts cheese, or does syringes. And they have just two or three rivals, and they're local. So every time they go to a restaurant, like, you know, where do you work? You know, it's like the name of your company is local pride on the line, honor. And what the result is that it's factory work, right? I mean, building these machines. But the workers really care, because it's a big deal to them to be from, you know, to be beating the other guy down the street. Because if you're losing to them, everybody knows. Everybody knows, and they're talking about it. So if you think about, what does this mean for the average workplace? Well, we all have employees, and we all have to try to motivate ourselves. But, you know, we all know the difference between, like, coming in and just doing your job, and coming in and really caring and really trying and forcing yourself to overcome those obstacles. And that's the kind of attitude you need to bring out in yourself and in your employees. And competitive focus will do that. That if you clear what your goals are and who you're competing against and where are they and where are you, you come to work every day with that kind of attitude and you achieve great things. Often both do. Both rivals will. So finding that kind of competitive focus, knowing what you're competing against, what's the measure of performance here, is going to affect any type of a company. And the opposite, having this broad sense of, well, there's this big market out here. I could do this. I could do that. I don't really know. Well, we're a little better in this. We're worse in that. Like, just all that's diffused. It makes it very hard for employees to really show up, you know, and to really show up and crush it during the day.
That's fascinating. And I want to get back to this boy-girl thing. And I didn't mean to talk over you before when you describing you versus Ashley's approach to work. But when she spoke in D.C., I was so enthralled by her speech. And she was talking how boys and girls learn to work in groups as children and how that plays out in their lives. Right. Can you talk a little bit about
that? Sure. So, again, the question is, why do we see women more reluctant to take risks or more reluctant to compete? Once they compete just as hard as men. But that choice to compete, why are they more careful and calculated about it? And one of the factors, you know, we know girls are raised differently than boys, right? And these things, one of the factors that we haven't thought about that should be part of that conversation every time we talk about it is group-based play versus pair-based play. And when kids are 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years old, when they spend their time in a group, playing in a group, they play a lot of games. They're allowed to have different roles. They can tolerate conflict because there's natural mediators built in. And they can also tolerate conflict because they often have a unifying purpose for why there is a group. In the first, we are the group that plays Power Rangers or Star Wars or whatever it is. And so in that, so all those ways, and then because groups are loud and there's a lot of people, you have to learn to be assertive. You learn assertiveness, and you actually learn self-aggrandizement when you're talking about yourself, for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. So group-based play teaches all those things. In some ways, it's a precursor for these competitive skills in life. Pair-based play is the opposite. Pair-based play is where the pair is there because they're friends, because they're the bestest of best friends. And to be best friends, to maintain best friends, is because they have similarities. So any differences between people become hidden or swallowed or ignored or pretended not to exist because they threaten the pair. And pairs tend not to be self-aggrandizing. They tend to be self-deprecating. People don't want to look different or better than the other person in the pair, so they self-deprecate. And they learn to have this sort of diminished sense of themselves. And they also, pairs take turns. While in a group, you have to like assert yourself to get your turn. In a pair, you take turns and nice and easy to do this. And this could affect boys and girls, either one. If boys were playing in pairs or girls were playing in groups, should get these effects. But girls are prone to and socialized to play in pairs. And so by the time they're about 2 to 3 years old, girls will be spending 2/3 of their time in pair-based play and 1/3 of their time in group play, and it's the opposite for boys. But it increases right in those years of between preschool and right before kindergarten. By the time they're 5 and 6 years old, girls will be spending 80% of their time in pair-based play, and boys will be spending 80% of the time in group-based play. It's so profound that when they do these studies, if they give girls, break them into groups to give them a task, they will sort themselves into pairs within the group. And I saw this. Like my wife and I mentioned we coach a lot of youth soccer. My daughter's team, she's 8 years old now. We've been coaching her since she was 5. We noticed with their team last year, like they were kicking the ball to the other team. The other team would kick it back like a tennis match. And they would kick it and they'd dribble it up to the other team and then they'd go right to the girl's feet and then they'd back away and the other girl would kick it back. It was like ping pong. And we realized they're taking turns with the other team. And that became our mantra, stop taking turns. It's always your turn. And then at practice, we would break them up to scrimmage at practice. And there's a blue team and an orange team with colored vests. And no sooner we put 6 girls on the orange team than they would pair up. They would find a partner, like you're my partner on the orange team. It's like this profound attraction that's been wired into them, that that's a comfortable social form, is that pair-based form. And what does it do? Well, if you want to compete with your friend, it's established, I'm better than you, it means you're going to risk the friendship. If in a group-based play, you learn that you can compete and not threaten your relationships. But little girls doing all this pair-based play learn that to compete is to risk the relationship. And so competing is fraught with you can win, but you will lose friends through winning. And this affects women's decision-making throughout the – becomes a habit throughout the rest of their life, that to choose to compete means I'm going to burn a friendship somewhere around here. I know that because they have that deep memory. And it's probably true.
It is true.
Yeah.
And you just got to get comfortable with it.
Yeah, and you're going to lose these friendships over it, and that becomes this calculation that makes it very hard to just – makes it not so easy to just go compete for the sake of competing. If you're going to lose a friendship, you'd better win. It's the only thing that makes it worth it. Losing, I lost my friendship, and I lost.
Yeah, sometimes
so that makes them more calculated about when they're going to compete. Once they do compete, they can be just as hard, but they're calculated in that.
And this plays out with the reason that more women aren't in politics, Ashley was saying.
Very much so. So the same decision over whether to compete, when women do enter political races, they tend to win just at the same rate men do very well. They raise just as much money as men do. In the recent election cycle from last November, we certainly saw when women are on the ballot, they can run. But they don't put themselves on the ballot in the first place. And last year in 2012, 180 million American women, only four women in the entire United States filled out any sort of a form at their local electoral office or city hall to be on the ballot for governor. And I'm talking about a primary race, not even like the final race. Like, that's not a lot of women willing to be governor.
No.
And the problem is they're going up against incumbents. So to in most political races, when you're going up against an incumbent, the odds of winning are very poor. It turns out that women will... when the odds of winning a political race are lower than 20%, all of the candidates will be men. Men who are ambitious and want to run for higher office ignore the odds. They just like want to do it. Women are very, very calculated about those odds. And when the odds get above 20%, you'll start to see women joining a race. When it gets to 30 or 40%, then more of them will enter a political race than men will. They'll be more competitive and more focused on winning than men are. But they only want to run for office if they really think they have a good chance to win. And they don't want to waste time with losing. So in a sense, women are more focused on winning while men are more focused just on competing itself.
Fascinating. All right, let's talk about stress and competition. Yeah. In the first chapter, you talk about a scientist, I believe in Germany, Renate Denzer.
Yeah.
And she tested the stress levels in people jumping out of airplanes 3 times and also in ballroom dancing.
Yeah.
So that, which is, you know, opposite ends of the spectrum, and yet the findings were very interesting.
Yeah, so they found that basically that ballroom dancing was just as stressful as jumping out of an airplane. And what's interesting is that you can acclimate to jumping out of an airplane really rapidly. Like by your third jump, jumping out of an airplane is no more stressful than, say, driving in slow traffic. But ballroom dancing is just as stressful as ever as jumping out of an airplane, even if you've been doing it for 10 years. And it's not the dancing that's stressful. It's not the music playing. It's the sense of being judged. It's the sense that you're performing in front of other people, and every line of your leg and lift of your wrist and look on your face and hair and every step is being judged. And you're doing this in front of other performers as well who are comparing themselves to you. And to be compared and judged is inherently stressful, no matter in that you might think that, okay, people who've been doing this for 10 years, they don't find it stressful anymore. And that's what makes them so great. But their stress levels are just as high as someone who've just been doing it, you know, for a very short period of time. And so the question is then, well, wow, you know, I mean, sure, it tells us just how stressful competing is. I think we kind of know that. It's stressful. So what separates the novices from the professionals then, if they both find it stressful? You know, Bob Hope used to say that if before a performance, if he wasn't stressed out and anxious, he knew it was not going to be a good performance. He knew that if he was stressed out and anxious, it would be a good performance. And that tends to that connection. So in our society, we have this message today that stress is detrimental to performance. So I'm stressed out, I'm not doing well. Stress is a bad thing all the time. Long-term stress is bad, but short-term stress is actually improves performance. And it's the ones who make that connection and come to understand it and associate those two who do their best. Why does it improve performance? Well, there's a level between stress and distress, but stress is adrenaline and noradrenaline in a ratio of 4 to 1, and it increases, it goes right through the spinal cord, and it opens up all the blood vessels and relaxes all the smooth muscles throughout our body that line our blood vessels, so those open up and they dilate, and your heart starts pumping, and this is called a challenge state. The blood is pumping through your body, your lungs are open so you can breathe really well, so you oxygenate all that blood, so you get a lot of great energy transfer, and this affects your brain, your perception of the world. It juices up the brain's reward networks, and it dampens the fear networks. So you feel very comfortable, you feel very relaxed, you're energized. So stress is this, like, extra energy. And most people do great when they're in that kind of a state. And people don't realize that. There's a lot of the stress is it's your body's giving you the energy to deal with your problem. But a lot of people don't like it. They're like, oh, I'm not relaxed. I'm not my calm self. And so they associate it in this negative way, and it turns into a negative thing. So we need to make this connection. Jeremy Jameson did this amazing study where he took Harvard undergraduates who were studying for the GRE, the graduate record exam, and he brought them into his lab, and they took a sample GRE on a computer. But half of them, right before they took it, there was a cover letter, and the cover letter basically said, like, new science shows, we're doing a study connecting anxiety and performance, and new science shows that being anxious isn't necessarily a bad thing and might actually help people perform better. Mm-hmm. And if you're feeling anxious today, just keep that in mind. They scored 50 points higher out of 800 on the quantitative section of the GRE exam on that practice test. That was it. Never heard about it again. 2 months later, they took the actual GRE, 65 points higher.
Wow.
We're talking about the difference between 700 and 7. These are smart students. They're Harvard students. 700 score to 765 out of 800. So I can tell you, by having this right attitude, you can get a 765 out of 800. You'd want it. That attitude is understanding that short-term stress, momentary stress, will help you. You want it.
Awesome. And it leads me to my next question, which also sounds counterintuitive, that warriors can beat warriors.
Right. Well, I mentioned earlier on at the start of this interview, Adele Diamond and her, listening to her talk about this gene that determines whether some people need stress to do their best and other people really need to avoid stress to do their best. And this gene, the COMP gene, regulates, there's two different genetic variations of it in our society. They're both very popular, they're equally distributed in our society. So the result is that half of us have one of each type of gene. We have a warrior gene and a warrior gene. We got one from our mom and one from our dad. And we have both types of enzymes working in the front of our brain. But a quarter of us have warrior-only genes, and so we have the warrior enzyme working in the front of our brain, while a quarter of us have warrior-only genes, so we have the warrior enzyme. And the warrior enzyme clears dopamine at four times the rate of the warrior enzyme, and it creates these two dynamics. So the result is that if you have the warrior genes, you are going to perform your best under a lot of stress. And you can handle actually quite a lot of stress. It's when your challenge actually is when that you're not stressed out on a day-to-day basis. Actually, you can have lowered, suppressed dopamine levels, and the front of your brain won't work as well. On a day-to-day basis in a non-stressful environment, the worriers, those who have the warrior gene, they actually have a 10-point IQ advantage, a cognitive advantage of 10 points over the warriors on average, on a day-to-day basis. But under stress, their brains melt down and it goes the other way. So obviously, when you hear this, think, okay, well, this is very sexy. Obviously, I want to be a warrior. Who doesn't want to do well when it counts? You know, I don't want to just do well in practice or nonsense. I want to do well when it counts. But I want to try to convince you that actually being a warrior is a good thing. So first of all, the warrior gene was one we share with apes. That's been around forever. The warrior gene is a new entrant. And it's extremely popular now. It's as popular, as common as the warrior gene. It must have been doing something really good for us to become that popular. You know, this mutation wouldn't have got to this point if it wasn't achieving something. And what it is achieving for us is the ability to worry about the future, which is to think ahead, to plan, to anticipate problems. Yeah, that's worrying. But when you anticipate problems, you solve them. You see them coming. And those, to be a warrior is a good thing. Like, I would recommend, like, our Secretary of State, you'd think, well, that's someone who has to deal with stress. No, that's someone who should be planning ahead and seeing problems before they happen. And that's what the warrior gene brought humankind. It means, though, that those people are not as good under stress. So what can you do if you are under stress? Well, the important thing is to learn to acclimate to recurring stressors. So those with the warrior gene have a generalized stress response. Something, I think that I have a warrior gene. So something could happen to me right now, totally like that never happened before, that's really stressful, and my brain would go, ah, I love this. This is great. And other people would be like, I can't handle it. I'm stressed out. Like I have it's a generalizable ability. It doesn't have to be something I've ever seen before. Warrior gene people will not handle unique novel stress as well. But if they've seen it a lot, if it's recurring, if something's happened regularly in their life, they can actually acclimate to the recurring stresses and not have this warrior curse. It doesn't, if you acclimate to it, have a lot of experience with it over time, and learn to control your stress response, you won't have this brain meltdown. Airplane pilots who've, if they're just a recreational pilot, they're not going to handle stress very well if they have the warrior genes. But if they put in the extra 1,000 hours of training to get
you know, trained to fly by night just off instruments, and maybe a few hundred more hours of training, then they tend to be able to actually handle the stress of flight problems very well, even though they have the warrior gene. You know, so the lesson is that this is, first of all, it's going to affect kids more than it affects adults. But for adults, you need to, like, learn to acclimate to the recurring stressors. So the risk, here's the problem. In our society, stress is bad for you, right? So stress is, you have to avoid stresses, avoid the things that stress you out. Well, what you do is you're also avoiding learning to acclimate to those stresses. So you want to acclimate to them. So I, you know, I got to go back to this with coaching kids in soccer. I clearly had kids with the warrior gene. I could see it. I could see that they didn't handle, you know, these stresses very, when, you know, we're playing. So I actually started taking them around the state. I took them to play at high altitude, and I took them to play in the cold, and I took them to play in intense heat, and I took them to play in tournaments where never was you ever heard English in the whole city, you know, like, and they got used to all that these are the stresses of playing soccer. And now a stressful experience comes along, and it doesn't freak them out. I mean, they would prefer it not be there, but they don't, they used to just wilt, and now they fight. And it doesn't seem to stop them. And so I think the lesson is that you can acclimate to some of these stresses. Can't acclimate to all of them. You know, like standardized testing stress people out, right? Well, if the more you could, would think, well, just take more standardized tests and you get used to it. You don't seem to. You know, that's a unique kind of stress that you don't really seem to acclimate to if you have the warrior gene. But if you have the warrior gene, hey, bring it on because you love those things.
It is fascinating, and I'm glad to hear that because I'm taking the red eye, so I'm glad that the pilot will be able to acclimate. I could just talk to you about this stuff all day. I do have one question in Chapter 6. I love the title of this, The Utter Importance of Pillow Fights. Tell about that.
Well, we mentioned group-based play versus pair-based play earlier and the importance of that rough-and-tumble quality of childhood to develop the competitive psyche. Along those same lines, sibling competition, having siblings and rivalrous feelings and enmity and hatred and competing over racing from after you brush your teeth, racing to the bed or racing to get dressed or, you know, all that stuff that kids go through with siblings, that rough and tumble quality also helps develop their competitive psyche. And yet one more way to do this is through roughhousing. Now, this is, sounds like dangerous, a roughhouse with your kids. Like, actually, most parents roughhouse with their kids without knowing why we're doing it. But it does seem to be that we are primed to do this to build up healthy competitive skills in our kids. You know, over 70% of men and about 70% of women are going to roughhouse with their young kids three times a week at least already. And we're talking about pillow fights or playing tickle monster or hiding behind the curtain and saying boo and all these types of things we do with our kids, pretend wrestling. And now, what's important and distinct about roughhousing with parents than roughhousing, say, with siblings, is that with siblings, it gets out of hand, right? 7 out of 8 sibling conflicts end without any sort of a compromise whatsoever. But when you roughhouse with a parent, parent can control the emotional environment. So you can get quite aroused right to the point where the kid's saying stop or it's too much. And then the parent can control it. And that's if it was with a brother or sister, that's right the moment to go out of hand. But with a parent, you come back down off that cliff. And we all know the fervor of competing. We all know that when we compete, we have to compete hard, but there is that line you can't cross. You can't lose it. Doesn't help you to lose it. It's unsportsmanlike to lose it. It's bad form to lose it. It's socially embarrassing to lose it. And you have to learn to compete really hard without crossing that line. And it seems to be that actually through roughhousing with parents, it's that same situation. You get energized right up to there without losing it. And kids learn that. They learn to be, in a sense, tough competitors but still a good sport. Through roughhousing with their parents, that's the where we develop that competitive skill.
That's just fascinating. So, as we close down on this, tell us what your biggest takeaway is and what you really want us to learn from this book.
Well, I just hope that this book motivates people. It makes them remember. I think
even amongst entrepreneurs. Competition is seen as, well, we know it's supposed to be this good thing, but it's like, can be not fun on a daily basis. And I hope people who read the book just remember that competition is fun, it's interesting, it's compelling, it's dynamic, it gets the blood boiling, it gets the juices going, it's worth it. And, you know, it's more than any particular point, it's all of them together, I hope, make people have the zeal for competition. I didn't say this at the top of the hour, but, you know, one of the other factors for me was about 3 years ago, I broke my left femur off, and I had to have a lot of metal put in, a metal hip and stuff.
How'd you do that?
It's very, very, well, the bone was dying, I guess. It was very, very painful. I'd had many surgeries. It didn't work. It was very painful. And it was hard for me to sort of have the same get up and go after, you know, during that and after that. And I got to say, researching this material and learning it and spending time around these stories of competition on a daily basis re-energized me. It brought me back, gave me that zeal for lean, for attacking the challenges that are in my life rather than sort of feeling fatigued and tired for them. So I hope that's what the book does, is it gives people the zeal to attack the challenges that they face. Far more that than any particular point.
Wow. Well, this is definitely worth reading. And to listen to Ashley and Poe, if they're coming to a city near you, you must go listen to them speak. Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing by Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman. Tell us how we can obviously buy it on Amazon. How else can we learn more about the book?
Our website is topdogbook.com. My Twitter handle is @PoeBronson. And you can find us on Facebook at Facebook.com/TopDogBook.
Awesome. Definitely do it. I highly recommend it. You will learn a lot from this book and from these two fascinating, brilliant authors. It's Top Dog, The Science of Winning and Losing, and we wish you all the very best. And we hope to talk to you again when you write your next book. Do you have anything on?
Nope.
Not yet? All right.
Well,
we'll keep
you. The next one
we'll keep you on. We'll keep our readers and listeners posted. You are listening to the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show on the Incandescent Radio Network, the voice of entrepreneurs. Here's to your incredible, indelible, incandescent success. We'll talk to you soon.
So that's it for today's Incandescent Entrepreneur Show, where we always ask, what's your story? If you have a good one and would like to be interviewed on the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show, send me an email to hope@hopegibbs.com. Check back every Monday at noon for a new episode of the Incandescent Entrepreneur Show on the Incandescent Radio Network, www.incandescentradio.com. We look forward to talking to you next week. Here's to your incredible, indelible success.